From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. In the effort to counter threats from China, the United States will share its nuclear-powered submarine technology with Australia. The move is part of a trilateral defense partnership with Australia and the United Kingdom. Here's President Biden speaking yesterday during a virtual press conference with his Australian and British counterparts.
We need to be able to address both the current strategic environment in the region and how it may evolve, because the future of each of our nations, and indeed the world, depends on a free and open Indo-Pacific enduring and flourishing in the decades ahead.
For more, we're joined by Christopher Johnson, head of China Strategies Group and former senior China analyst for the CIA. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yes, glad to have you. So this is only the second time the U.S. has shared its submarine technology. The first was back in 1958 with Great Britain during the Cold War. What's the significance of collaborating in this way?
Well, I think it's a fundamental recognition that as we seek to meet increasing challenges, especially from countries like China, to deal with the massive increase in naval building that they've been doing over the last several years, we have to work even more closely with allies and partners. And of course, ourselves and a lot of our allies have increasingly limited budgets for these sort of things. So my sense is this is a way for us to not only stretch the dollars, if you will, within the community to increase our capability, but also just another formal sign of bringing the Australians ever closer to us and the UK as part of that classic relationship between the three countries.
Let's parse this out a little bit more. The announcement comes as territorial disputes in the South China Sea have escalated in recent years. Help us understand what's going on there.
Obviously, it's been a process over the last several years now where China has increasingly built out facilities on these islands. Started in roughly 2012, the Chinese action in Scarborough Shoal, and then was followed by, of course, a lot of land reclamation and so on that's happened since then, which has really given the Chinese virtual control over the South China Sea. So the U.S. and its allies and partners obviously are trying to contest that changing chessboard on a fairly regular basis, mainly with the message that we will maintain the right of freedom of navigation to go through any international waters and to show presence to the Chinese. So obviously the Australians have been increasingly involved in those exercises. The UK, for the first time not so long ago, will be continuing to do so. And so this is just sort of an iteration, a new iteration, if you will, of the message to China that we will contest your efforts to turn the South China Sea into a Chinese lake.
We should be clear, this is about submarines powered by nuclear energy, not weapons. What will Australia do with this technology, and how will that affect what happens in the South China Sea?
Well, I think that's going to be an interesting part of this. And, you know, it's my sense that the administration, of course, was very clear in saying Australia is not pursuing nuclear weapons. And in fact, one of the main reasons why this decision was made was because of Australia's strong record on nuclear non-proliferation and non-proliferation in general throughout the years. It will be a challenge, technically, of course, because Australia does not have an indigenous nuclear capability or community. So in terms of maintenancing and so on, that will be challenging. But obviously, I don't think we would have made this announcement unless we thought those technical challenges should be solved. In terms of the South China Sea, obviously having nuclear propulsion allows for long stay deep sea patrolling.
Thinking more broadly, the U.S. is investing more of its resources here at a time when it just pulled out all of its troops out of Afghanistan. Is this the future of U.S. military strategy?
Most definitely. I mean, I think one of the things that pullout from Afghanistan allows is that you've, for 20 years, you've had forces, dollars, obviously, and a lot of policy attention, sucking up energy, if you will, in Afghanistan. That's all being released now to be redirected elsewhere. And so it's kind of interesting in that many of the architects of the original so-called pivot to Asia during the Obama administration are now back in the Biden administration. Kurt Campbell, who is the Asia czar at the National Security Council, was critical in that effort. And now they may actually get to more properly carry out that strategy from now nearly a decade ago.
You know, the U.S., Australia, and the U.K. didn't specifically call out China in making this announcement, but China is still criticizing this move, comparing it to the Cold War era. How threatened does China feel, and how do you think they might respond?
Well, they're certainly not going to like it. And they will see this, of course, as yet another installment in what they generally describe as U.S. and allied efforts to contain China's rise. In terms of their reaction, my sense is we'll continue to see this drive more escalation in terms of not only the building of capital ships by China, but increased controls. And it, you know, obviously validates the sort of senior leadership of China's view that indeed the U.S. is trying to cobble together a sort of similar coalition to that that faced the Soviet Union during the Cold War to contain China.
Christopher Johnson is head of China Strategies Group and former senior China analyst for the CIA. Christopher, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
The remnants of Tropical Storm Nicholas are lingering over South Louisiana. And that means 5, maybe 10 inches of rain through tomorrow. This comes just 2 weeks after Hurricane Ida, and all that water is slowing the recovery. Meantime, demand for contractors and housing materials is skyrocketing. Let's bring in Matt Sledge. He's a reporter for the Times-Picayune New Orleans Advocate. Matt, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Yes, good to have you here. Can you set the scene for us? You've been reporting up the river from New Orleans in St. John the Baptist Parish. Tell us about the place and whether it's still an emergency there now.
Yeah, I think it's less of that intense emergency that it was 2 weeks ago or even a week ago. Most customers in St. John have electricity now. You can actually buy gasoline without waiting in line for hours. You know, the concerns now are, I think, more about dealing with your insurance company, dealing with the government. And the additional rain we've had over the last few days has not helped at all because a lot of these houses also have wind damage, you know, that's torn off some shingles or even large parts of roofs. And if you don't have a tarp or some kind of protection up there, the water's coming right back in. And there's also this problem that we have in Orleans Parish as well of the trash contractors not picking up the trash. So everything stinks right now. You know, if you can imagine the contents of refrigerators just lying out in the hot Louisiana sun for 2 weeks, that's what we're surrounded by.
Wow. Well, let's talk about tarps and roofs. I mean, you've been reporting that Ida damaged some 80,000 roofs. I mean, this is a lot of damage in addition to the wind damage to the siding of homes. The Army Corps of Engineers does have an emergency roof program, but how's that going? How much of a resource is that to the people?
So it's really just getting off to a slow start. So in the meantime, people are putting up their own tarps or they're having roofers put up tarps because you've just got to get something on top of your roof. And, you know, some people found out very quickly that the tarp jobs they had applied themselves weren't very good and water started coming in. And I was actually driving around Jefferson Parish, and I saw in two houses on the same street, people up on the roof in pouring rain, nailing down tarps and kind of fixing the jobs they had done weeks earlier.
I wonder if you have a personal anecdote about all this that kind of stays with you, whether you wrote about it or not, that you're like, this is one person I'm going to be thinking about for a while.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I guess, a week after the storm. And I spoke with a woman who had lived in La Place for like 20 years and had this home that was really just her dream home. She was a retired school cook living on disability. And, you know, this had been the home where she entertained for her whole extended family, you know, loved to cook traditional South Louisiana foods there. You know, like some fried fish or something like that for people. And then in came Ida and just ripped off a bunch of her roof. She was there with her grandkids when this happened. Oh. And it was clearly a traumatizing experience. But still a week later, it was such a struggle to find somewhere affordable to stay because her home was unlivable that her and five of her relatives were sleeping in this rental SUV at gas stations every night. And it really just underlined just how people, you know, who went through very traumatic events when Ida made landfall have not had literally not had a moment's rest since then.
Wow. Now, from far away, many of us might think about these trends, we have these storms that seem to be coming more frequently. Some of them are pretty significant storms. We're learning more about climate change amplifying this effect, and when the waters are warm, these storms are growing. Do you hear anyone trying to survive, kind of thinking about these big climate change and other questions, or are they just trying to get to tomorrow?
It's funny you should ask that, and it was literally like 3 or 4 days after the storm, and I was standing interviewing people in line at the Home Depot in La Place, and I was talking to one woman who actually worked at a chemical plant down here, and she just turns to me and says, "Global warming is real." You know, just almost shouts it at me. So, yes, people are definitely thinking about it.
Matt Sledge is a reporter for the Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate newspaper. Matt, thanks for the time.
Thanks for having me.
A new book for young adults gives us a kid's eye view of the pandemic. It centers around the character Geth, a high school senior in New Rochelle, New York. She's hoping to go to Columbia University, struggles to cope with the death of her father, and her OCD, or obsessive-compulsive disorder. Geth finds refuge in the music of the K-pop group BTS, even though she knows no one else in her school, certainly no other black girls, listen to songs like this one, BTS's Zero O'Clock, which gives the book its title. Zero. But all of Geth's concerns will be overshadowed, first by the pandemic and then the Black Lives Matter movement. Zero O'Clock is by author and former music critic C.J. Farley, who joins me now to talk about the book. And C.J., welcome to Here and Now.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
What really strikes me about your choice to focus on the children is that it really brings home for us that the pandemic has happened to them, too.
I think this is exactly right. I mean, there's so many books that will probably be written that will be like contagion, like thrillers, the scientist that actually, you know, cracked the vaccine and the way in which the government responded to the pandemic in general. All of that is really important. But this was like a seismic shift in the way in which kids live their lives. A lot of them are wildly destabilized because of this. It's going to change their outlook on friendship, on love, on the universe. And I think it's really important to have documents out there to help them process it so they can figure out, well, what the heck did happen to me? And that's one reason why I wrote Zero O'Clock, because I wanted to put on record, here's one story to help you better figure out what your own story really is in all this.
You have two teenage children. How much of them did you put into this book and into your heroine, Geth?
I reached out to kids that my kids knew. My own kids looked at my book. They gave me pointers. I actually created a Google Doc for this book so kids in the neighborhood could go in there and give me the suggestions. And all of that, I think, helped lend authenticity to the project. It can make this a book that I hope kids will enjoy reading because they'll see themselves in it. They'll see their friends. They'll see their own experiences. And it won't be this kind of literary broccoli they sometimes get in schools where they say, this doesn't really represent me.
Oh, CJ, your process with that Google spreadsheet sounds really fascinating. One of the details of your heroine, Geth, is that she's a super fan of BTS. Why BTS?
Many years ago, I was offered tickets by one of my college roommates to go see BTS. And my daughter and I decided, BTS, why should we go? And I was a music critic, and I'm sort of a music snob. I covered everyone from, you know, Lauryn Hill to Bob Dylan to Taylor Swift. And I thought, who is BTS? Why should I go see them? Well, my daughter later did some more research. She began listening, and she really got into them. And she has great taste. She's someone, sometimes when I walk in, she's studying, she's listening to Charles Mingus. So she knows what she's talking about when it comes to good groups. And when she got into them, I got into them too. And I began to realize this group, there's a lot more going on with them than a lot of music critics give them credit for. And so I thought when I had this heroine, if she was gonna love a group, it had to be BTS because of the depth of their music and because, you know, they're the kind of group that other kids sometimes make fun of because they don't understand what's going on with them and they need to be educated. So I thought it was great to sort of put them as part of the group. And also BTS, they have fans like no other fans really out there in music history. Their fans aren't just followers. They're kind of all leaders in their own way because they take it upon themselves to really fight for BTS and their interests and advocate for them and make sure their singles chart high on the Billboard charts.
What you're saying here is really important because music really does play such an important role in the forming of identity, especially for teenagers, doesn't it?
Yeah, and music really, it links you to a certain time and place. I still remember back in 2012, I was running a music mini concert program for the Wall Street Journal, and we had in someone who was then kind of a little-known singer, Adele. And I remember having her in a room, and she was warming up. It was just Adele and me in that room. And she sang Someone Like You, a song that would later become one of her signature hits.
Never mind, I'll find someone like you. I wish nothing but the best of you too.
And I'll never forget that moment because it's so powerful. It's like this kind of Proustian, in a moment where it links you to a certain time and place, where that moment in Ratatouille where the food critic has a bit of the food and he's suddenly launched back into his childhood. It felt like that for me. And it just showed me the way in which music can anchor you to a particular time. When we think of decades in terms of music, there's a soundtrack for each one of them. And so I think when we look back on 2020 and the moments we're going through now, I think a lot of people remember this through the music of BTS. And so I thought it was important to sort of make that part of the book and make music and the way it links us to certain stories in our lives and times in our lives part of the narrative of 0 o'clock.
There are some other details that you go into in the book as well. Geth, your main character, has OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. And your descriptions are so vivid. For instance, she has to have all of her pens and pencils lined up in a certain order. But then comes the pandemic when we all are preoccupied with things like washing our hands. And it seems to actually lessen the main character's symptoms as she goes through the pandemic. What were you trying to say here?
Well, I consulted with a psychiatrist to make sure that my depictions of OCD were accurate and they were depicting things that people actually went through during the pandemic. And to me, it was important to show a young person dealing with some mental health challenges, because so often, especially unfortunately in the Black community, we don't always reach for the mental health checkups and the mental health help that we need. There's some shame attached to it. We don't want to admit that we need help. And I felt by portraying a sympathetic character who's going through these things, who's facing up to her own mental health challenges, maybe kids reading it, adults reading it, would be more likely to go out there and get the help they need for themselves and for their kids and show there's nothing to be ashamed of.
Through Geth's eyes, we also get to experience how the death of George Floyd galvanized protests around the country. I'm really fascinated with this part of your writing because, you know, I think we've seen this throughout the country in real time with young people who felt galvanized to kind of speak up and find their voice. What parts of you and your family's experiences did you incorporate in this part of the book?
Well, my daughter can be something of a radical. I mean, she's out there marching for women's rights. She was out there marching for Black Lives Matter, and I was with her. And it was really something after all the time being cooped up in her house, social distancing, doing everything right, staying within the family, you know, wearing her mask, eventually getting vaccinated, to suddenly find ourselves called out there, realizing we have to put ourselves in the line here because we can't let this go on. We have to stand up and say, yes, our lives matter. Yes, the lives of these young men and young women that have been taken unfairly, they matter too. And I thought it worked well in my book because one of the groups that actually was most outspoken, or I guess out-tweeted, if that's even a word, was BTS. Here's a South Korean group that actually tweeted out their support for Black Lives Matter when it was very controversial, when people were talking about it, when people were debating it. They wanted to put themselves on record saying, yes, this is something we support. Black lives matter to us. I thought it was a very powerful statement from BTS, and it endeared them to fans all the more.
We don't want to give away all the details of this book, but it really does feel hopeful. It's about young people and what they've experienced in this last year. and the losses and their new sense of purpose. Are you hopeful for them?
I am very hopeful for young people and for the world in general. You know, I think that this year has taught us many things. And this old professor of mine from Harvard, Professor Sandel, Michael Sandel, who said something very interesting during the pandemic, how there were these two opposing values in the pandemic of social distancing versus we're all in this together. And it's been difficult for us to reconcile how those two work together. But I think part of the solution is realizing that we have all these challenges like the COVID crisis, like climate change, like racial unrest that we need to deal with together in order to actually solve them. And that's one thing the heroine tries to do in this book. And she actually finds inspiration in, of all places, BTS, because I think that good groups, whether they're U2 or the Beatles or the Wailers or BTS, I think they model good behavior in how to work together in the group. Every group member seems to have their place. And whether it's the political Beatle or the cute Beatle, or whether it's RM and all hit the members of BTS, they all have their place. They all work together. And that's why they're great. And that's a great model for all of us to sort of embrace as we face serious social challenges in our world. And that's part of what Zero O'Clock is all about.
Author and music writer C.J. Farley's latest book is Zero O'Clock. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
And this is BTS's Life Goes On. We got a positive economic sign today. The Commerce Department reported that retail sales increased a bit, 0.7% in August, after sales fell in July. Just how significant is that increase? And what does it tell us about the Delta variant and what it means for the economy? Where does inflation fit into things? NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley joins us now for more. And Scott, what more can you tell us about this retail sales report? Can you put that increase into context for us?
Sure. Well, this is better than most forecasters were expecting. And it does tell us that, you know, consumers are pretty resilient despite the surge in new coronavirus infections tied to the Delta variant and despite the still pretty serious challenges with the supply chain. Folks managed to pony up a little bit more money in August than they did in July.
This increase came even though there was a big drop in car sales, for instance, which is connected to shipping problems and shortages. Where are we seeing lags in spending right now?
Yeah, car sales were down almost 4% in August, and we've talked a lot about the computer chip shortage that has really hindered the production of new cars. There just aren't a lot of new cars for sale on dealers' lots, and those that are there are pretty expensive. So that's hitting auto sales pretty hard. We also saw spending in bars and restaurants flat in August, and that's not surprising. In fact, maybe it's surprising that it wasn't worse given the rise of the Delta variant. But we saw strong sales in home furniture stores, strong sales in department stores, and very strong sales in online stores. So consumers are still spending. Do keep in mind, this report mostly just covers spending on stuff. With the exception of restaurant meals, there's nothing in here about spending on services. And spending on services is probably more sensitive to the public health outlook. And so we might see a bigger dip in spending on things like entertainment, travel, when we get that report later in the month.
Oh, thank you. That's a big distinction and note to make. What about inflation? Does inflation appear to be impacting how Americans are spending?
Well, it certainly affects the prices that they pay. And these, yep, these spending figures are in nominal terms. So you can think of about 0.3 of that 0.7 is just higher prices, not more stuff. But the rest is more stuff. We did see inflation for August come in a little bit lower than it was in July. Prices over the 12 months ending in August were up 5.3% compared to 5.4% in June and July. So a little bit of easing in inflation. And in the month-to-month numbers, the slowdown in inflation has been more dramatic, from 0.9% in June to 0.3% in August. So it may be that the worst of the inflationary spike is behind us, although some of those drops are not so good. Some of them are in things like rental cars and airline tickets. And that's not because supply chain kinks are being worked out, but because people are a little more frightened to travel in the current environment.
Yeah, a lot to look forward to the fall and the winter, with a lot of questions about the Delta variant and expectations for our economic recovery. That's NPR.
Yeah, we've said so many times
that the
economic outlook depends very much on the public health outlook.
Absolutely. That's NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley. As always, thank you.
You're welcome.
Many families of 9/11 victims still want to see classified documents on what the government knew in advance of the attacks. For instance, how closely was Washington following al-Qaeda members? And did the hijackers have links to the government of Saudi Arabia, an ally of Washington? Last weekend, the Biden administration declassified the first document ordered by the president. It's a long-secret FBI report. No smoking gun, but let's bring in Tim Golden. He's writer and editor at ProPublica and has been chasing these questions for years. Hi, Tim.
Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, and first, tell us, what is this report? Who wrote it and why?
This is a report by what was called Operation Encore. That was a decade-long follow-on to the original FBI investigation of the 9/11 plot. And that whole investigation had really been almost entirely secret until we first reported on it extensively last year. And this report that came out on the anniversary of the attacks was a kind of compendium of circumstantial evidence and leads that had been developed by the Operation Encore team. It is kind of an inventory of different pieces of evidence that were found connecting particularly a couple of Saudis linked to the Saudi government with two of the hijackers, who were the first two men from the plot who arrived in the United States in January of 2000.
In this document, what more do we learn about direct, indirect ties between the hijackers and the Saudi government, the Saudi consulate in the U.S.?
It had always been known that two of the hijackers had met up with a kind of a shadowy Saudi man who was a graduate student in San Diego and who claimed to have run into them by chance at a little restaurant in Los Angeles. And what turns out, according to this document, is the meeting seemed much more deliberate and almost kind of a secretive operation to connect them right after this Saudi had left another meeting at the Saudi consulate in Los Angeles and had gone directly to wait for them at a particular restaurant. He then invited them to San Diego. He found them an apartment immediately. He lent them money briefly, and he helped them in all sorts of other ways. And these were two guys who, although they were pretty well-trained as terrorists, really couldn't speak English at all, couldn't understand street signs, couldn't navigate their way around a Western society. So they were sort of lost without significant help.
Yeah, and as you kind of step back and look at these big investigative questions, you know, how important is this new knowledge, you think?
Well, I think it adds to the picture in a pretty significant way. What it shows you is that this Saudi, who had already been investigated by the FBI as a spy before 9/11, was in touch with some other Saudi government officials who were part of the religious bureaucracy of the kingdom and were also assigned in the United States as diplomatic personnel. And those two Saudi religious officials, in turn, had a whole bunch of connections to other militants, to people who were connected to al-Qaeda, to people who were connected to other terrorist plots. So the picture has really gotten much more complicated.
As you're describing it, these are important connections to understand more about. We're here 20 years later. This document is heavily redacted. The victims' families are asking for a lot more from the government. Why would the federal government, this administration, previous administrations at this point want to be so secretive?
You know, that's a great question. That has been one of the big questions surrounding this entire episode. What are they hiding? And it's really striking to see this document that the Attorney General of the United States, Bill Barr, during the Trump administration, went to court to assert that this was a state secret, that the publication of this document could imperil the security of the nation. And when you read this, you think, well, this is certainly embarrassing. It certainly suggests that a couple of lower level Saudi religious figures had some connections to these hijackers and to possibly to militants or terrorism that was not known. But it doesn't look anything to me like a state secret. And, you know, I've done a lot of reporting in this area. So I think what is still being held back and why are really big questions here.
The families of some of the victims have a lawsuit against the Saudi government. Does this push them, you know, any further in the direction they want to go?
I think it helps them maybe to get some more documents. And it's not entirely clear that they have to hold the Saudi government, you know, from the top down responsible. But they do have to find that Saudis who were agents, acting as agents of the government, knew that there were bad actors here and, you know, helped them nonetheless.
And finally, do we have any expectation that more of these kinds of documents are going to be declassified by the Biden administration?
Well, the president issued an executive order about a week before 9/11, and that was under a lot of pressure from the families who asked him to not turn up at anniversary events if he wasn't going to disclose more information. In that executive order, he has promised to disclose a whole bunch more documents, but I think the families, while they were encouraged to see this document that just came out on Saturday, are still, you know, somewhat skeptical, because the same kind of promises have been made by every administration going back to George W. Bush, and they have really been disappointed by each one in turn.
Yeah. And just very quickly, the Saudi government, any response for them? Are they still denying any involvement here?
The Saudi government has always denied having any involvement in the 9/11 plot, and it continues to do so. But there's a lot of questions that remain unanswered here.
All right, Tim Golden, editor-at-large at ProPublica. Tim, thanks for the time.
Thank you.
For a while now, U.S. women's soccer players have been pushing for equal pay to their male counterparts. And this week, that effort took a new turn. Now U.S. Soccer says it's proposing identical contracts for both teams. But the players aren't cheering just yet, as NPR's Laurel Wamsley reports.
In an interview with NPR last year, Megan Rapinoe, the face of the women's fight for equal pay, sums up the differences in the men's and women's team contracts this way.
When you look at the possibility of money for each team, ours is vastly, vastly lower than the men.
The disparity in pay has been particularly glaring when you compare the team's successes. The U.S. won the Women's World Cup in 2019, while the men's team failed to even qualify in 2018. The top-ranked U.S. women won the bronze at the Olympics last month, while again, the men didn't make it to Tokyo. Now U.S. Soccer says it's offering identical contract proposals to each team's unions. U.S. Soccer says it's offering a single pay structure for the men and women. But what's actually in these proposed contracts isn't known. Does identical mean that the women will make as much as the men were earning before? Will the men make less? The Women's Team Union criticized U.S. Soccer's announcement as a PR stunt. The U.S. Men's Players Association did not answer a request for comment. In an interview with the Aspen Institute in July, U.S. Soccer President Cindy Parlow-Cohn said that she and everyone at the Federation is committed to equal pay. The big challenge, she says, is the huge difference FIFA pays men's and women's teams at the World Cup.
The vast majority of the $66 million that the women's national team is litigating over is the difference in the FIFA World Cup prize money between the men's World Cup and the women's World Cup. It's not something that U.S. Soccer controls, and to ask us to make up that difference is just untenable and would likely bankrupt the federation.
In its statement, U.S. Soccer called on the men's and women's teams to come together to solve the World Cup prize money issue. The Federation says it won't agree to contracts that don't meet that goal. Laurel Wamsley, NPR News.
Okay, one confession and one request now. I put off the dentist in the pandemic, happily, till I needed, no kidding, a root canal. And it turns out a quarter of us fear that chair of the dentist. And we want to hear from you for a story we're chasing. Do you need a deep breath or two before walking into an appointment? Do you tense up in the chair and not even realize it, like me? Do you suddenly get creative when you cancel the dentist? I'm sorry, I need to stay home and, I don't know, finish that coffee table book. We want to understand why and what can be done to help. So open wide and tell us your experience. There's a form here at hereandnow.org, or you can email letters@hereandnow.org. Throughout the pandemic, we have all craved human connection. And in Cambridge, Massachusetts, the source of this sound has been creating it, along with a lot of joy, on Saturday mornings. Andrea Shea of our home station WBUR went to a park along the Charles River to learn about a public dance project called Tap for Joy.
It's definitely not something we hear and see every day. Nearly two dozen people tap dancing outside.
Tap for Joy was founded on my personal belief that it is impossible to be unhappy while you tap dance.
This all started when jazz tapper and singer Jenny Herzog was feeling anxious and isolated last fall.
I had just quit my job and I was sitting around in my apartment, depressed, just like lots of my friends and family.
So the 30-year-old put her Tap Creates Joy theory to the test and posted an invite for free outdoor classes.
First, it was just some friends. We put up this handwritten sign by the tree that says Tap for Joy every Saturday, and people just walk by and see the class and come, and then word just spread.
It wasn't Herzog's sign that drew 23-year-old Natasha Stark to the class.
One day, I was walking home from somewhere and I could hear tapping. So I went into the park to find the source of the noise, and it was Jenny running a class. So the next week, I was there. And I've been there most weeks since.
All right, so first thing I want you to do is just close your eyes and listen.
I think tap has just like this magical elixir of music and movement, and it's just a joyful art form. So my goal specifically was to use tap dance as sort of a mental health tool for people, especially during COVID.
Toe, heel, toe, heel.
Each student taps on their own 2x2-foot wooden board designed by Herzog. They're spaced out on the grass in a big circle. Early on, Herzog says people showed up in sneakers and sandals.
I now have bags and bags and bags of donated tap shoes.
There's a lot more tap shoes over here if your size isn't over there.
Herzog sees tap as a percussive instrument. She is a jazz singer, so the class also does a lot of scatting. The city of Cambridge gave Herzog a grant to also teach classes at community centers and schools.
Welcome, Reese. So glad you're here. Reese was one of my students at Fletcher Maynard.
That's where Herzog introduced 8-year-old Reese Jackowitz to tap, and now he's really into it.
Because you get to move your body when you tap back and forth, left and right, diagonal.
Jackowitz moved to Cambridge from New York during the pandemic with his mother, Iyabo.
Reese is on the spectrum, very bright, but he's also very creative. And when I found tap, I was like, that's a kind of lost art.
Check out Reese's step. Two. Whoa, here he goes.
Reese's mom says Herzog's class has been his lifeline, and watching her son definitely brings her joy.
I was really choked up. I'm serious. I had like a tear come to my eye when I saw him out there. I was like, this has been what has kept him going.
Same for 62-year-old Kathy Drummy, who's been working from home for what feels like forever.
Everybody's so happy when they come here, and that's rare, for me anyway. You know, after working all week, stressed out, thousands of emails, this is my Saturday sanctuary, I guess.
Drummy's usual tap classes were canceled because of the pandemic, and before finding this outdoor alternative, she says she would tap at home in her slippers. Then there's Mary Lou Hakuta, who's 75. She used to take Zumba at her gym and is grateful for this new way to move. Now she wishes Jenny Herzog would add another class or two.
look how many people come out for it, of all ages and ethnicity. It brings joy to a place like this too, you know, that you have something like this every week. It's so good for a neighborhood, a community. It's a special gift.
All right, who else has a step? Go back to making your own steps.
Now that Jenny Herzog feels her theory has been proven, she wants to take Tap for Joy to as many communities as she can. For Here and Now, I'm Andrea Shea.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.